The Athletic.
If you're not yet a subscriber to The Athletic, now's the time with our best offer ever. Sign up today and you'll pay just £1 a month for the next 6 months, giving you unrivaled insight and analysis of everything Euro 2020 and taking you well into the new Premier League season too. The Athletic is the only place you can read pieces by award-winning writers like Michael Cox, Rafa Honigstein, Amy Lawrence and Daniel Taylor. And when you subscribe, you'll also get ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts from across its audio network. Head to theathletic.com/totally and become a subscriber today for £6 until the end of the year. That's theathletic.com/totally.
Good afternoon, passengers. This is a pre-boarding announcement for Flight 89. Please have your boarding pass and identification ready.
Spotless back to the
Oh, Schmeichel saved it, but Kane is there! What incredible drama!
Unbelievable. Destination, well, Wembley again, as Kane puts the Danes back on the plane and England head to an actual final. We look back on a night to remember, from Damsgaard's opener to Sterling and Tumberling to the manager's decision to have a jack-off in extra time. Plus, there's a nod to Sunday's opponents Italy, Spain's reaction to their exit, and that big shot window for unemployed player Leo Messi in Saturday's Copa America final. It's totally at the Euros in association with Paddy Power. Yep, that's the sound of history. Living, breathing, crashing in through your television screen. Listener, thank you so much for joining us. It is Thursday the 8th, the day after. And we're joined here on Totally at the Euros by Daniel Story. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, James.
Duncan Alexander, he's here too. Duncan.
Hello, James. Hello, everyone.
Hi. Say it, Daniel. Say it.
England are in the final.
Woohoo!
And yeah, I'm not ashamed to say I shed a little tear at full time, partly because it was a horribly tense, fraught, emotional match, and partly because for the first time in my lifetime and a lot of England fans' lifetime, we're in the final. I've just done this England book and I've worked out that 54,280 days after England's first game, we're going to have our second final. That bit of it hasn't really sunk in yet. It just feels like we're having a really good time and the magnitude of that has not quite hit home and probably will take until Friday or Saturday to do so.
Well, you know what? Other nations would say the magnitude of what? You haven't actually won anything yet, but savour it. Savour it, Daniel. Drink it in. It's a moment of history, Duncan. Anything you want to say to the nation, kind of matter face style?
I'm not sure that's the accepted style in a lot of places across this very happy nation. But it's ridiculous that a country with the football heritage and wealth of England has only reached its second final. But, you know, I think the whole Southgate era has been ticking off these things that haunt the English game. You know, there was the penalty shootout in 2018 against Colombia. There was, you know, going to extra time. This was the fourth semi-final in a row that England have reached that's gone to extra time. The previous ones, the first two in 1990 and 96, went to penalties. England lost. And then in 2018, just lost on classic goals scored to Croatia. But it didn't really feel like that was going to happen at all. I mean, it felt like England needed that extra 30 minutes because they were so on top and they were going to get a goal and they did. And that's what's different. You know, that's what's different about this team is that we're not destined to win every game and we might lose heavily to Italy in the final. But if they do lose, it will be because of stuff that happens on that day, not because of these kind of nightmare thoughts that haunt the nation and have done for 50 years. So, yeah, it was I think the whole Southgate era has been a period of just shaking off these demons, and we saw that again tonight.
Yeah, who would have thought we'd be saying that, what was it, 6 months ago, that the whole of the Southgate era was that? Tremendous congratulations to Gareth and his boys who go through to the final on Sunday against Italy. Feel a bit bad for Denmark. Well, everything they've achieved, everything they've been through at this tournament, providing a much tougher contest than many expected, playing quite brilliantly at times for most of the regulation 90 and a little bit cooked in extra time. And I mean, they'll be pretty unsatisfied, I imagine, to be losing out on that Raheem Sterling penalty call.
Yeah, I suspect that's right. I actually think it was almost a mirror of the first semi-final in that it was kind of possession versus attempted Lightning counter-attack. Lightning counter gets the goal. Probably Denmark, you know, had more of the game than Italy, it's fair to say, at that point. But then possession comes back into the game, and then it's just a question of whether that possession can ride it out. I think the difference is exactly what you say, James, is that Denmark seem to have Baku legs because they have, you know, they've done the travelling. They'd already had a tough second half against the Czech Republic, a long way from home and certainly a long way from London. And I think that probably eventually told. I think that became obvious as soon as England had scored the controversial penalty, because the initial thing to do was to sit back, which is what England always seemed to do, and invite pressure onto them. And within 5 minutes, I think Southgate got a message out to say, look, these Denmark players are goosed here. You don't need to sit back and just defend this. Give the ball to Raheem Sterling, let him run at players and we can keep the ball. And that last 2 minutes, very much a case of recency bias, but that last 2 minutes is probably my favourite 2 minutes ever watching England, because that isn't England. We don't just take the mickey out of an opposition by keeping the ball and playing it man to man and side to side and not even letting the opponent get a touch. We go back to our own goals and back ourselves to head and hoof everything clear. And that was so cathartic watching that last 2 minutes, because that was when I was expecting everything to reach a nervous crescendo, and actually it all went very calm.
Yeah, you're totally right. And, you know, England's overall pass completion in that game was 87%. Now, that might not sound amazing to some people, but trust me, that's not England. In Euro 92, England ended the tournament with a pass completion rate of 64%. You know, Keith Curl at fullback, just crashing out of tournaments left, right and centre. That's what England did for decades. And it wasn't because they didn't have the players. It's because they didn't have the kind of... They wouldn't accept there were other ideas or other ways to play football. And I think that's what's changed. And it's taken some stuff that isn't necessarily great in terms of how polarised the Premier League can be compared to the rest of the Football League and stuff like that. But we finally have a generation of players who aren't scared of the ball and can keep the ball. And as Daniel said, that last couple of minutes was, at no point did it look like England were going to panic and lose their heads. And that's been a long time coming. Actually, if you actually think of the 1966 World Cup final, the most famous moment in it is England smashing the ball up the pitch with a long pass, and Jeff Hurst, rather than keep the ball in the corner, which he should have done, smash it towards goal. All right, it went in, and yeah, whatever. But, I mean, overall, we've come a long way from that.
Yeah. All right, well, a little bit later on, you can nominate your Wembley heroes from Wednesday night's game. But first of all, should we have a little look back on how this enthralling match unfolded?
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Woof, as they say in Denmark. Mikael Damsgaard there. It's been a blitzkrieg start from England. And when they play like that, my word, they look as fearsome as anything in football. But it was Denmark who steadied the ship, rode it out and took the lead with that free kick from the young Sampdorian midfielder. What a strike.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. I think England were slightly foolish to give away that free kick, because I think the original one was overhit, and I think Denmark were always going to be a threat from set pieces, although I expect it to be headers rather than shots from 25 yards that dip over a wall and into the not quite top corner. But I think Denmark spooked England with their pressing. The one thing England hadn't really faced in this tournament was a side that really harried and hassled Rice and Phillips in midfield. You know, Germany, player for player, are better than Denmark, I think, but they sat off England. Croatia seemed to sit off England. And I think it scared England. I think, you know, they needed to respond quickly, because I think the longer that game had gone at 1-0, the more sure Denmark would have been of themselves. And it was a phenomenal free kick. Jordan Pickford got a little bit of criticism. I can kind of see why, in that standards seem to have increased now with goalkeepers, where if it's not right in the corner, you, in inverted commas, should save it. But the dip he got and then the power because he used his instep. I mean, phenomenal skill. It wasn't quite the knuckleball. It was almost a sort of halfway house of knuckleball and side foot curl, which...
Well, it reminded me of a free kick from the 1990s. It was very kind of Zola or Hasselbank or something like that. It's a sort of free kick you don't really see that much anymore. And I think, yeah, you can possibly... Some people did blame Jordan Pickford, but I think that's a bit harsh. He'd just set a new record a couple of minutes earlier of the longest any England goalkeeper had ever gone without conceding, overtaking Gordon Banks, his previous record of 720 minutes, and then, you know, classically within a couple of minutes had conceded. But, yeah, I don't think you can really blame him for that. It was just really well hit.
All right. Well, the how would England react question was then very much on everyone's mind, and the answer is well.
Yeah, they did what they'd not really done until that point, which was... rather than kind of play passes through the centre and then look to dip out, they finally got players down the wings and beyond the last man. And it's a fabulous ball from Harry Kane, who, you know, I know this year has felt like decades, but this tournament has also felt a long time, because that worry about Kane, we need a proper centre forward, we need a striker that stays in the box, kind of loses its weight when Kane's getting two Man of the Match awards in a row and dropping deep to link up play and still having shots. And that pass for Bukayo Saka was perfect. And I think Raheem Sterling would have liked to score it, having missed the chance 2 minutes before, or hit Schmeichel 2 minutes before, but he kind of forced the ball over the line, I suppose.
Well, you mentioned Schmeichel's save with his phenomenal midriff on Sterling's shot. And it wasn't long before he pulled off another, even more astonishing stop on Maguire's header, that outstretched hand.
Yeah, he seems to have this David Seaman ability. He's the keeper I remember doing it the most, where you watch a save in real time and you think, that's a decent save. And then you watch it again on the slow motion replay and it becomes a 3 or 4 times better save, because he just has these... He has these enormous hands and this incredible reaction times. You know, I hate the fact that within 3 or 4 seconds of Schmeichel making a save, everyone, you know, commentators and pundits alike have to talk about his dad. But he is a genuinely world-class keeper in his own right now. And yeah, I think he'd already made the save of the tournament before this game. But as I say, he just seems to make really hard things look very, very easy. Unfortunately for him, I think he probably made a slight mistake on the penalty in that I think he tried to catch it rather than parrying it, which spilled the ball out a little bit. But I don't think we can ever blame goalkeepers for saving penalties.
Well, he's got a pretty bad Premier League record against Harry Kane, who, you know, frequently smashes a lot of goals in for Spurs against Leicester. But Daniel, I know you don't want people mentioning Peter Schmeichel shortly after Kasper, but he made 9 saves in that game. That's the most by a Denmark keeper in a tournament game since his dad, Peter, in the 1998 World Cup. And he actually, if you take XG on target, so that's where you look at the expected goals, where the shot's hit in the goals. It's not just from where the shot's taken, it's from where it, you know, if it's in the top corner, that's got a better value than right down the middle. He actually had an XG prevented in that game of 2.95, which is the most of any keeper in Euros history, recorded Euros history. So, he, you know, well, the man of the match...
How long have they been doing XGA?
XGOT.
XGAT.
Yeah. Since 1980, so since tournaments began in the...
Seriously?
Yeah, yeah.
This has been kind of like shadow society, collating this information in secret.
Runs it.
Yeah, it's like Biff Tannen's Sports Almanac, but better. But basically, yeah, so that just shows. It's what I don't think it will really get noticed that much because of the narrative about England, but... It's arguably one of the great goalkeeping performances Wembley Stadium's ever seen. So,
well, was it though? Anyway, let's get back to the game. By now, Denmark, maybe, am I skipping too far forward, getting a bit leggy? And Hjulmand takes off, arguably, Denmark's two most dangerous players, Damsgaard and Dolberg. Does that play a part in this? Are England getting their confidence back? They started brilliantly, as we mentioned, and they finished regulation time with an equal attacking intent.
I think Denmark probably got that slightly wrong, only with the benefit of hindsight, because it was a proactive move which they felt they needed to do to try and shift the flow of the game. But what it did allow Southgate to do is to hold back, deliberately hold back his substitutions. I think the danger when both sides make a number of substitutions at the same time is that the game can get very bitty. Whereas actually what happened is that England kind of continued with their effective control without creating huge, you know, huge and clear chances at that time. But then when the substitutions were made, they really did change the game, I think, in England's favour. And certainly in extra time, Denmark were shattered, noticeably shattered.
So extra time gets underway, and by now it's a question of when, Daniel, for you or Duncan?
Yeah, I mean, it felt pretty inevitable. England had six shots in the first half of extra time, obviously two of those from one penalty, essentially. But it was actually quite similar. I did an article this week looking at England's previous semi-finals, and if you look at the Euro 96 semi against Germany, England didn't do that much in the second half, but actually played really well in extra time and had lots of shots, which I think is maybe one of the reasons Terry Venables famously didn't make any substitutions, which I think we've learned tonight that substitutions are good. But yeah, I think it felt inevitable, really. I mean, the penalty was soft, as we've mentioned, but I think England could have had two legitimate other penalties in the game. So
two, really?
Yeah, there was the Kane one in the first half.
Which, I'm going to say it's not a pen. I know there's an angle which makes it look like a pen, but the defender gets the ball before him and Kane then kicks the back of the defender's leg before going over. So I find it hard to see why that could be anything more than I've seen them given. Sterling's, meanwhile, I'm going to say that beyond the fact that there wasn't any contact, I am kind of the opinion if you do stick a leg in front of a player, you know, the player can go down with some justification. And
I think there was. I think there was some contact.
Was there some contact?
Yeah, I think it's the initial. On the TV, they made it seem like it was for the second nudge. I don't think it was. I think it was for the first leg that clips Sterling's right leg. And I have to say, I mean, I would have been annoyed if I'd have been an England fan and that had gone against me, of course.
Yeah.
I think it was soft. But for 2 years, we've been screaming at Raheem Sterling that if he gets clipped, stop trying to stay on your feet, because you don't get penalties if you stay on your feet. And the reality is that in the VAR era, if you get a clip and you go down, you know, you make the referee make that call. Make VAR look at that. And I thought it would have been overturned, I have to say, or I thought they would at least ask Danny Macchielli to have a look at it. But I can see why, if it's given, it's not overturned, because if there's contact and the penalty's given, they're not going to overturn it.
Yeah, it's arguably the most tense England penalty since the Beckham one against Argentina in 2002, which was won from a worse simulation, I would argue. Poor old Mauricio Pochettino.
Good Lord, was it him? I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, well, so there you go. Sterling goes down, Kane takes the penalty, Schmeichel gets to it, but it bounces straight back into the path of Harry Kane, who slots it away, and his name enters the history books along with the rest of Gareth's Lions.
He's now gone level with Lineker with 10 goals at tournaments. It means he's scored 7% of England's goals at tournaments in their entire history, which is reasonable for someone who didn't have the best of group stages. But I think we should mention how both Kane and Grealish won an incredible amount of free kicks in the second half and the first half of injury time. It was, you know, there's not much industry left in England, but that is an industry. Those two just shielding the ball and waiting for the free kick, because it just broke up play perfectly. Anytime Denmark looked like they were building, it was such a great outball, which made it slightly surprising that Grealish was substituted as a sub at half-time and extra time.
Well, it's a rare thing for England. I saw this stat. He's only the third England player to ever suffer that fate, ignominious or otherwise. Would you care to explain the thinking here, Daniel?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was fairly simple in that Southgate wanted to bring on a defender. Probably thought that Phil Foden was maybe better at kind of the little passing interchanges on the right-hand side to keep possession, was never going to bring off one of the central midfielders or a defender, and was never going to bring off Harry Kane. And I think Raheem Sterling, we'll probably talk about him in a few minutes, but I think he was England's best player and proved in that second half of extra time that he had the energy to keep direct running. So I think it became quite a simple decision. I understand it's a big thing because it's one of kind of football's great jokes when a player is brought on and then brought off. But I hope that Grealish, you know, I'm sure Southgate will have explained it to him. I hope he reacts positively to that, because I do feel a bit sorry for him. But I think it made sense. He was a little bit sloppy when he came on. He did lose the ball a little bit. We know that Southgate has a slight issue with the lack of tracking back, which is something that Foden cannot get away with at Manchester City. He does that relentlessly, and so does Sterling. So I think it kind of made sense. It just seemed a little bit unfortunate. And we should say it was a massive call, because if Denmark score an equaliser and England lose on penalties and Grealish has gone off, that becomes the story. That becomes the reason why Southgate isn't up to the job. Let's be honest, that's what people would say. So again, kind of massive kahunas from Southgate, who just certainly doesn't shy away from those kind of calls.
I mean, he'll probably say to Grealish, you got 35 minutes and Foden got 25 minutes, which is essentially what happened. And, you know, they both did well, but I guess neither of them directly massively influenced the game. So, yeah, good subs to have, I guess.
Duncan, you marked Harry Kane's equaling of Gary Lineker's record of goals at major tournaments. A word for own goal, who is now up to 11 strikes for this tournament.
Yeah, there'd only been 9 in the history of the Euros before this tournament. So it has been a pretty massive uptick in own goals. But if you actually think about how teams play now,
right?
In England do it as well. They get to the byline and pull it back. You are going to get more own goals. Own goals have gone up recently because of the way teams have worked out. One of the most profitable ways to create good quality chances is to get to the byline, pull it back, and someone, you know, a striker's going to run in or a defender has to make a decision. And that's essentially what happened with England's first goal.
And that's the science.
Kane slowly takes steps back and is ready to take the penalty for England. Oh, Schmeichel saved it, but Kane is there on the rebound, and Kane buries it into the back of the net.
Harry Kane there, slotting that penalty away with no bother whatsoever. And, well, a night of history for England. Even though nothing's won kind of in terms of titles, it's a massive leap forward for this side. What moment do you think from this epochal game, possibly pivotal, will you be carrying with you, Duncan, you know, for the dark times ahead? Something to look back on, a little touchstone.
Probably the 10 seconds or so of slow-mo celebration after the Kane rebound goal, because often in football a player will score and teammates look reasonably happy, maybe the guy that assisted it looks happy, and then everyone in the distance kind of turns away. But if there was a shot and you could see, I don't know, 6 or 7 of the England players, some of them on their knees, just the sheer joy. Like Phil Foden was almost about to explode with joy, I think. And it was, that's where you realise the pressure and the kind of the weight of history and the weight of expectation that was on these players. And, you know, whatever happens in the final, they're the second England team ever to reach a final. And I think you could see that in their faces.
Has a game against Denmark ever felt this big? Daniel, what was your special moment?
I mean, I've mentioned that those last 2 minutes, so I have to pick a moment from that, and it would probably be Sterling's run when he picks the ball up in his own half.
Sterling's showing great pace again. Fantastic energy levels he's shown in his game.
Somehow, after 118 minutes, has the energy just to... Firstly, he sprinted past 2 Danish substitutes and then just keeps driving and driving and driving. And it's times like that I just want to grab him and say, we all want to grab him and say, look, this is how good you are. Like, you can do this all the time. You've got all the ability in the world. And I'm so chuffed for him this tournament. And that was just the perfect embodiment of that. I wish he'd scored. Obviously, again, Schmeichel made a great save. But that won the corner that effectively meant the game was over.
Mm. Duncan, who do you make your man of the match?
I thought Kyle Walker and Saka were absolutely brilliant in the first half. They really kind of nullified Mahler. But Kyle Walker is, you know, he's 31 now, but his pace is extraordinary. He offers a level of covering or coverage that no defender in England's squad can do, and in most other squads as well. And he is just such a brilliantly calm, yet also quite manic person. Do you know what I mean? And it was there were a couple of moments in the game where he just swept the whole width of the pitch with his pace, and I think you know, he's, whether England play with a back three or a back four, he's integral. And my main concern, I enjoyed the run that Daniel mentioned there of Raheem Sterling, but when any England player ran with it towards the end of the game, I was terrified someone's hamstring was going to go. Do you know what I mean? It was like kind of just slow down, just take it easy. Yeah. But yeah, it was, I thought Walker and Saka were great.
Daniel?
Yeah, I think Walker's recovery pace in behind is almost a cheat code for England in terms of the defending. I know he occasionally makes mistakes and gets into trouble, but the way he's able to just kind of sit on the sideline when an England player, Stones or Maguire, is going up for a header and then just immediately sprint in beside to clear up the danger is like nothing else that an England player provides. Declan Rice as well, who is it becoming a bit of a teacher's pet of mine, because I think there are a lot of people who don't quite understand, because you aren't constantly always on the ball and you aren't always doing something, that means you're not playing very well. But the ability of him at 22 to read exactly when to surge forward with the ball and when to surge forward without the ball to either thwart or start an attack, he plays like a 27, 28 year old. And if you'd have been told 6 months ago that Jordan Henderson would have been fully fit for this tournament by the knockout stages and wouldn't start a game and England wouldn't look like they miss him, that's down to Rice and Phillips as well. But Rice, I thought, was brilliant.
Was the official man of the match Harry Maguire, or was it Raheem Sterling?
Kane.
Oh, it was Kane, was it? Okay.
Yeah, they've now started in the knockout stages resorting to FIFA World Cup type of who scored the goal that clinched the game, that's who gets man of the match.
A lot of people were citing Harry Maguire for a commanding performance there. And I was just curious, I mean, yesterday Adam on the show was mentioning the kind of massive journey that he's been on since last time against Denmark and the Greek jail, etc., and the red card and that. And we often talk about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and the fact that he doesn't notionally improve players, but does he deserve some of the credit for the way that Maguire has evolved as a player and a character on the field, or is that something that you think is probably down to Maguire himself?
I mean, he's played very well for Manchester United, so yes, absolutely, you can't take any credit away from Solskjaer for that. I think Maguire was already he's quite an independent figure in defence, in that he knows what he's good at, he knows what he needs to do, and he makes sure that he's allowed to do it, which is winning his headers, stepping up occasionally, coming up for set pieces, of which, you know, he's already scored one at this tournament and unlucky not to score another one tonight. If anything, and I don't want to get dragged into Man United criticism again, it makes me wish they had a genuinely brilliant ball-playing central defender next to him, because he is everything that you want from that defender's defender. You know, Giorgio Chiellini is almost certainly better than him at it, or has been better than him at it, but Maguire is that type. You know, he is prepared to do the dirty work, but he is also good on the ball. He's got pretty much everything. And he looks like a real leader. And, you know, Southgate got quite a bit of flack for picking an injured player, but even if Maguire wasn't on the pitch now, Southgate says, you know, he is a leader in that dressing room. He is dragging people on. And I think you can see that when you watch him play.
I mean, you look at that defence, you know, Walker, Shaw, Maguire, Stones, like, merge the two Manchester teams and that is some defence, but seems unlikely to happen.
Yeah, indeed so, Duncan. Indeed so. Well, you mentioned Chiellini. We will have, probably, lineups permitting, the Maguire-Chiellini matchup come Sunday night. We'll do a preview show for the final on Friday, actually, a special totally final preview. But just some hot takes on that, for many people, dream matchup of England against Italy. It's been a while since England have got the better of the Azzurri in an official match. I think you have to go back to 1977 and the recent tournament meetings. Well, the 2-1 victory in a World Cup in 2014 that didn't work out particularly well for either side. Before that, the infamous Euros game, which was a nil-nil battering, essentially, by the Azzurri, who then took it with the Pirlo, Panenka and stuff and on penalties. And yes, what would you think this time? I personally, I'd say the Italians are going to be extremely concerned about facing England.
Yeah, I think we're kind of predisposed to assume that England will struggle against Italy, probably partly because of history and partly because we haven't been in a final for an awful long time. But I think you're right, James. I think it's time to stop thinking, well, what are England's flaws, and think, well, actually, Italy did cede a number of chances to Spain that I think England would have finished. They haven't been perfect. You know, they stuttered against Austria. They haven't looked like their group stage selves. And England, other than at times tonight, look to be a team that's growing into their tournament. The other thing I would say is England have now faced some adversity. You know, it's very easy to say it now, England have won 2-1, but it probably was important and helpful that England have learnt how to come from behind to win a game rather than just, you know, holding teams off at arm's length and hoping to win 2-0. So I suspect the bookmakers will have England favourites because they're at home. I think it will be incredibly, incredibly tight. But, I mean, I'm almost not worried about it now because my fear of whenever England go into a tournament is there's going to be this horrible, angry call for root and branch reviews and kind of victimisation of individuals. And whatever happens now, we're not going to have this, which is
no root super crops on the back pages, you think? Duncan?
No, thank goodness not.
I just don't like watching games after England have got knocked out, but that's not a problem this time, so that's good. But I think the two football cultures of Italy and England, I think both respect each other a lot. I think a lot of Italians I know really love English football and vice versa. So it's a sort of final that obviously has never happened before, and I think it's a sort of final that will really capture people's attention and around the world. Obviously, we've got Brazil-Argentina coming up in the Copa final, but that happens fairly regularly for obvious reasons. But this is a kind of clash of two of the most important footballing cultures in the world in a major final. It's never happened before, and I think both teams, knowing the character of both sort of football cultures, both teams will be quite concerned about the other team. So I don't know whether that would affect the game, but if both teams play as they have at their best in this tournament, we could be on for one of the great finals. So let's hope.
It's a bold call from Duncan. Brazil-Argentina, actually, it's a while since they faced each other in the Copa final, but we'll have a quick word on that game very shortly. We're talking about one or two other things to do with Brazil. But before that, next up on this Totally Football at the Euros, let's have a quick word from Alvaro Romeo, because Italy's passage to the final, of course, came at Spain's expense. And Alvaro will give us the reaction the day after for Luis Enrique's side next.
Euros are here, and you'd better make the most of them, because they only come around every 4-5 years. So, if your bookie isn't making you feel special, then maybe it's time to find a new one. Yep, not so much carpe diem as carpa diem, yeah? If the grass is greener on the other side, come and play on it. If your bookie's not giving you the best rewards, switch and you'll get a completely free £5 bet builder on all England's group games. Paddy Power.
Pre-match bet builder bets only min 2 plus legs online exclusive. Must have previously deposited to avail. T's and C's apply. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts.
Vamos, Sandro! Vamos, España! Jorginho resopla con
vamos,
la carrera.
Vamos.
Busca bien la derecha. Chuta Jorginho. Gol de Italia. Gol de Jorginho. Estamos eliminados. Qué cruel es el fútbol.
All right then, Alvaro Romeo joins us for a little brief interlude with some thoughts on Spain's, for them, untimely exit from Euro 2020. Alvaro, first of all, what's the reaction been in Spain to Las Rojas' exit?
Well, of course, it's been a disappointment, but I think that it could have been a different type of disappointment if Spain had lost differently, if Spain hadn't been convincing this tournament, if they hadn't progressed until the semifinals. I think that the front page of Marca encapsulates it very well, saying, with honor, I think that Spain lost the game with honor. Maybe they deserve more. But after all, this is probably what you would have expected, or more than you would have expected from this team. Definitely a month ago, when there were many critics about the team. Some players like Llorente and especially Busquets had COVID before the tournament. Sergio Ramos being in the squad, an inexperienced group of players. I think that having reached the semifinals and all that make Spain very proud.
Okay. What did El Chiringuito have to say?
Yeah, that show, El Chiringuito, that normally spurs on controversy and maybe stays on the surface. Well, I think that they were focusing a little bit on the Jordi Alba and Chiellini incident before the penalty shootout as well.
Saying what?
Saying that basically Chiellini ripped off Spain for that, or that maybe what? Jordi Alba. In Spain, the feeling, yes, is that Jordi Alba basically was ripped off in a way, but not in a bad way or anything, by Chiellini, because apparently Jordi Alba, you know, had chosen...
Had won the toss.
Had won the toss, yes.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of a mention to that, of course. Not bringing any Real Madrid players has been still, for some, reason for controversy. That mm-hmm. was mentioned yesterday. But generally speaking, I think that the rest of the media outlets and platforms, they've been rather complimentary, and they have accepted that this team have done an excellent job, and that they have been representing the country with honours.
That's what they think. What do you think, though, Álvaro? I know you're pretty unhappy about the exit.
I could say that I am proud of Spain because they have played football very well. Collectively, they have done many things well. I think that then some execution problems in the opponent's box and in defense have costed Spain a lot. Every through ball in between the defenders in the knockout stages has been a real problem for the Spanish centre-backs. The goal against Switzerland was a lack of understanding between Pau and Laporte. I think that Eric Garcia and Laporte, again, could have done better in the goal of Chiesa yesterday. But generally speaking, my feeling is good. I think that this is a good generation of footballers. 7 or 8 players of this Spanish team, they have 2 decisive years ahead of them before the World Cup in Qatar. I mm-hmm. think that it's very important that the likes of Oyarzabal, Pedri, Olmo, Pau Torres, Eric García, and many more make a step right. forward and become top players, because I think that this is not a golden generation of Spanish football. I think that this is a really good group of players, coached by an excellent manager. So, in my opinion, nothing should be changed, because this equilibrium is quite fragile. I think that there is a great manager and some players that they are ready to learn. So let's keep it and let's see what happens. And I believe as well that Spain needs somebody really good to score the goals. And at the minute, they don't have that player. And maybe Ansu Fati, in 2 years' time, ahead of Qatar 2022, or in 18 months' time, he can be that player. But still, we need to know how he recovers from his injury. And of course, a special mention for Pedri. I mean, it's not normal, it's not natural to play like this when you're 18 years old and to run the games with such a simplicity. I think Luis Enrique was tremendously complimentary of him as well, and he said that not even Iniesta was this good when he was 18, and I couldn't agree more.
This is interesting, because we'd heard a lot about Pedri, we've seen him in action, and we've seen the way that Messi enjoys playing with him, but to see him perform at that level really opens up quite exciting prospects about how good he could become, what kind of player he could become over the next 10 years.
Well, I think that he's already a really good player. I believe that there is a risk of burning him out physically, because he's going to play the Olympic Games as well. And right after the Olympic Games, he'll start the pre-season with Barcelona. So I think that Ronald Koeman and the Spanish national team, they have to look after this player physically. He's got a tremendous potential. He's a great ball carrier. He steals the ball in a very subtle way. And then his passing range is improving a lot. He needs to have a little bit more of a long passing. I believe that with age, he will become stronger and he will do that. And I will refer to some words of Pepe Mel, the former West Bromwich Albion manager, who said a couple of years ago, when Pedri was playing for Las Palmas, he had Pedri before his eyes, and he was talking to a number of players, and he pointed at Pedri and he said, "Look at that boy. He's a millionaire and he doesn't even know about it. He was so good at the age of 16 that, you know, even Pepe Mel or anybody else could spot that he was going to be a great talent." So Barcelona signed him, and I think that he's in the right team to excel. Now it's important that Ronald Koeman and Luis Enrique look after this player, and as I said before, not to get him too tired, because his legs are not endless. I mean, at some point, he needs a rest as well.
Absolutely. Álvaro, you mentioned Barcelona, not wishing to be negative, but what is the latest on the ongoing meltdown at one of Spain's biggest clubs? There was a lot of talk midweek about the fact that Barcelona can't register these signings that they'd made, Memphis Depay, Sergio Aguero, and also one that they're hoping to make, this guy Leo Messi. What's the situation? What happens now?
Well, you explained it very well. Barcelona needs to meet La Liga's salary cap, And at the minute, they've got many players that they have to register, and they couldn't register them because they will go beyond the salary cap. So now the trick for Joan Laporta and the rest of the directing board is to send as many players as they can on loan, or to offload players, or to transfer them if possible, even though it's not easy in this context, or even to tell them to leave for free. Something that Pjanic or Umtiti, for example, have been accepted. Okay. So the situation is quite tricky at the moment. Joan Laporta said a couple of weeks ago in front of an assembly that he didn't expect Barcelona finances to be that bad. This is the legacy of Bartomeu. And yes, Joan Laporta now is trying to do his best to keep Messi in the team. But let's don't forget, if Messi is registered, and Memphis and the new players and all that have to be registered, it's at the expense of offloading plenty of players. And when I talk about players, I talk about salaries, because in this time, everything in Barcelona is regarded in salary terms. Which player cost a lot to Barcelona? Well, if we can offload that player, that would be a blessing. So the likes of Coutinho, the likes of Umtiti, the likes of Trincao, who is gone, Junior Firpo is going to Leeds United. These ones, I expect them to have a turbulent summer. The thing is that many players at Barcelona, they make a lot of money and they say, why should I leave the club? I mean, I signed this contract in the past and I want to stay because it's my right. And they are right to do that. So it's going to be a very tricky summer for Joan Laporta.
Okay, and amongst all of this, what would you say the probability or possibility is that Leo Messi doesn't sign a new deal, possibly because they're not able to make room within their salary cap for the right kind of offer?
Well, to start with, I would like to see if Javier Tebas is absolutely not flexible with the salary cap. Because I don't know if it's good for La Liga to lose a player like Lionel Messi. At the end of the day, Lionel Messi is a tremendous hook for audiences. So that's something I want to see. But as the days go by, if Lionel Messi doesn't sign a new contract, obviously Barcelona is in jeopardy and the situation is becoming more complicated, because Lionel Messi at some point is going to say, hey, the new season is approaching. In a month time, domestic leagues are going to start and I don't have a team yet. So I think that the more the situation prolongs in time, the more dangerous it's going to be for Barcelona. And there are some teams in there who had the money to pay Lionel Messi. Lionel Messi knows already that Barcelona is not going to offer him the same conditions he had in the past. So, you know, the best thing that can happen to Barcelona is that Lionel Messi doesn't have to choose between two offers.
Right. Okay. As you say, it should be sorted out as soon as possible. This whole situation, though, so far has been a little bit like something that everyone assumed is going to get taken care of because it's Barcelona. And yet it just seems to get worse and worse. So I'm not so sure I share your optimism. We shall see. Alvaro, thank you so much for that roundup. I look forward to speaking to you soon on the Totally Football Show.
Thank you, James. Take care.
Woof, Alvaro Mayo there. Hey, Chiellini controversy, saying he conned Jordi Alba. Did you see that? Is that everybody else's take as well?
No, it seems that... what was reported is that Alba had effectively chosen the wrong end. He got the end wrong. He'd made a mistake and then tried to change it. And Chiellini was like, I'm not having any of that. But then, actually, the referee then tossed the coin again.
Yeah.
So I don't...
Now, apparently, the referee, Dr. Felix Brick, first of all tossed the coin for the end and then tossed the coin to decide who would take the first penalty. And in both occasions, Jordi Alba came up short, which, you know, not to... But anyway, but Chiellini certainly took it all in good humour and Jordi Alba less so. Anyway, very shortly, we'll be talking a little bit about Brazil and the Copa America final and what the number one unemployed player in the world has been up to of late. First of all, though, let's get some quick odds from Paddy Power over to producer Ben.
Thank you very much, Jimbo. That was fun, wasn't it, listeners? Jason Murphy from Paddy Power is on the line. Jason, we're a couple of days out from the final. We'll speak again before Sunday, but give us a bit of value a few hours after the final whistle.
We've England slight favourites at 4-5, Italy 10-11. We consider England not to be as good as Italy, but it's those very vocal home support and home comforts that make the difference. Italy are the better team, but when you factor in that crowd, they really are the 12th man. Believe it or not, at Paddy Power, Italy would actually be a bigger loser for us in terms of a tournament winner. They took more bets at slightly bigger prices than England throughout the tournament. However, Paddy Power himself, in all his wisdom, despite odds compiler telling them it was crazy, he decided on the eve of the tournament to do a massive special on England at a price of 8-1 to bring it home. That special by itself will cost us nearly £1 million if England do the job. So professionally, for me, for Paddy Power, there's no good result for us in this final. And personally, I've watched from a distance all the England drama and heartache, Euro 96, France 98. I was in Leicester Square in 2010 when that Lamps goal wasn't given against Germany. And the summer just seemed to end there. But I wished you well in the 2018 World Cup. A fantastic summer of fun and love trains. But I don't want England to win it. But I do want you to enjoy every minute of it. As for Italy, I've nothing against them. They have nothing against me. Bar maybe I like pineapple on a pizza. But all I really, really want is just a bit more drama for what has been a fantastic tournament. We'll see Chiellini tussle with Kane throughout the game, but we'd love to see him tussle with him at a coin toss as well for penalties. And England to win it on penalties is 15-2. And remember, you don't always have to have a bet. Particularly for a game like this, there's going to be plenty of drama and entertainment. So above all else, enjoy.
The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power. Find a bookie who loves you right back as much as Gareth loves right backs. Place a 4+ fold bet builder on any football match and get money back as a free bet if one leg lets you down. Check paddypower.com for more details. £10 max free bet. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman, host of The England Show, brought to you daily throughout Euro 2020. I'll be joined by writers from The Athletic and special guests to bring you unrivaled coverage dedicated to the England team this summer. So for expert insight into Southgate's squad and post-game reaction to all the games, search for The England Show wherever you get your podcasts or via The Athletic app.
We're all driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. According to their own survey, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Remember the last time you were hiring and how slow and overwhelming it was? Well, you don't need to go through all that again. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent. And because you listen to the Totally Football Show, Indeed is going to give you a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/totally. That's Indeed.com/totally. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed at Indeed.com.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Hey, listener, you know that £1 a month you just don't know what to do with? Sign up for a subscription with The Athletic for its unrivaled coverage of Euro 2020, and your problems will be over. Because along with getting rid of that pound, you will receive in return all the articles, all the podcasts ad-free, and Q&As with writers. That £1 a month deal, by the way, only applies to the first 6 months. Lord knows what awaits you after that. But I'm sure all the details are at theathletic.com/totally. On this day, everybody, love a bit of on this day. And today being the 8th of July, it's an 8th of July from yesteryear we turn to. Oof, this one's from 2014.
And a ball of Shagan! Go!
Duncan, do you know what that was?
It sounded like a heavy defeat for Brazil.
It certainly was. It's a game that has its own Wikipedia entry, which sounds impressive, but probably lots of games have their own Wikipedia
lots
entries.
Lots of games do, but if they do, then you know it's a good game.
Right. Well, this one was a good game for one nation and not so much for the other. It was, of course, the 2014 World Cup semi-final. Brazil against Germany. Brazil, the World Cup host. Brazil, who were on an extraordinary unbeaten run at home in competitive fixtures. How long? 39 years, 62 matches. Crikey. It came to a remarkable end on this day in history. Daniel.
Yeah, I mean, there are some games where you find yourself not really making noises, but just sort of doing little yelps and giggles as if to kind of almost to kind of reinforce to yourself that you are watching something amazing happening. There's no need to talk to anyone. I was watching it with friends, but there's no need to talk to anyone. You just all just sort of laughing at it. And it was absolute tragicomic farce for Brazil, because there was that, you know, there was that kind of sense of this is our tournament to lose. And they didn't just lose, they got absolutely, I mean, they got their whole psyche dismantled by Germany.
Right. 5-0 up after 29 minutes, the Germans. They scored four goals in the space of just 6 minutes, which is the fastest haul in World Cup history. Any other stats to try and explain to anyone who wasn't watching agog?
Well, at the end of that game, Germany had scored more goals in that match than England had managed in their past two World Cups combined. Obviously, now England are a superpower. We can look back at that and smile at how bad we were. People forget as well, it used up all the goals, because the other semi-final was 0-0, the first World Cup semi to ever end 0-0. So just spread it out a bit more and it would be better.
Brazil bounced back pretty well, actually. They are the reigning Copa America champions, and they're back in the final this year. They're on a decent unbeaten run as well under Chiche, and taking on Argentina this Saturday, as you mentioned earlier, Duncan. Argentina, who haven't won the Copa America since 1993 and have had a run of blowing finals in embarrassing fashion, although not quite to the same dimensions as that Brazil 1, Germany 7 result that we were just mentioning. By the way, just, you know, before we wrap it up, Argentina getting into the Copa America final, courtesy of Monday's, or I think Tuesday morning by the time it actually happened, a penalty shootout against Colombia. Did you see this?
Yeah, I saw Emi Martinez managing to one-up even Giorgio Chiellini's big penalty energy, the Jordi Alba, by, I mean, just some good old-fashioned trash talk, which is pretty much underrated. You see a lot of keepers sort of dancing across their lines and time-wasting and pretending that the ball feels a bit down, they want to have an extra feel of it. But just good old-fashioned cussing of an opponent to psych him out.
Yeah, and I think what was, I mean, for me, extra impressive about it was that he didn't just call them out and not just cuss them, but genuinely kind of move in with his furniture to their brains and say, look at me, I know where you're going, look at me. But each time he did it, I mean, with one exception, I think he had consecutive saves on Yerry Mina and Owen Cardona, Davinson Sanchez he also saved against. But it wasn't just that the players went wrong. He read their shot and stopped it. It was a fantastic shootout performance.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect there are times that we don't hear about where keepers try that and go the wrong way for 4 out of 5 penalties, and you know, it just doesn't really get mentioned. But yeah, if you pull it off like that, and he clearly did, you know, he clearly did get into the heads, and particularly the Yerry Mina one, I think he Mina ended up making it look pretty obvious as he was taking the penalty where it was going. So yeah, and just at the end of a pretty sensational year for Emi Martinez, having gone from Arsenal's reserve goalkeeper to Argentina's number one.
Well, I was going to say, like, you go back 12 months and he just about, you know, got into Arsenal's team through that injury to Bernd Leno. And then a year on and Messi's sort of talking about him in the post-match saying, Emi, we knew we could count on Emi. It's like, that's a good year. It's a solid year. But obviously there's the other thing as well in the final that Messi hasn't won a tournament with Argentina. And he's
well, apart from the Olympics. Don't forget the Olympics.
The Olympics does not count. That does not count. If it was 3-day eventing or some sort, that's fine. But not football. But maybe he's waiting. He's obviously not got a club, technically.
Yep.
Maybe he'll win this and then he's a free man to go and do whatever
he likes.
It's
a very useful shop window for him, isn't it? That'll be Saturday night or actually Sunday morning. What time is it on? Is it 1 a.m, kind of red button BBC thing?
Yeah, I think so.
Right. Excellent. Okay. Well,
on the Olympics, while Duncan mentioned it, news broke on Wednesday that Pedri is going to be taken to the Olympics by Spain, because if you have got a young player who can do everything, the best thing to do is to play him 75 times in the same year and hope everything stays together with PVA glue and sawdust. Yeah.
Right. And then straight back to Barcelona. Yep. Excellent. Excellent. All right. Well, as I say, we are back on Friday afternoon. So that'll probably be with you Friday evening, maybe Saturday morning. But sometime around then, listener, I do hope you'll join us for some erudite thoughts on our expectations for Sunday's big England-Italy Euro final. There'll be some other stuff in there too, perhaps. For now, thanks ever so much to Daniel Story and to Duncan Alexander, and as ever, producer Charlie for his nocturnal endeavours. And listener, to you too, see you Friday, and bye for now.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Keep up to date with everything Totally at The Totally Show on Twitter, and find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.